Welcome, 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 everybody, to the Hockey Think Tank podcast brought to you by thehockeythinktank.com, a website for all players, parents, and coaches to go for a little bit of education, a little bit of inspiration regarding the greatest game on the planet. In today's podcast episode, we actually are going to flip the script. And Jeffrey over here is going to actually interview me about my journey through the hockey world and what has kind of led me to where I am today. So, but before we get to that, let's introduce the man, Jeff Lovecchio. Jeff, what's going on today?
I've got the black lung pop. I'm over here coughing my head up like I'm Zoolander right now, but I'm committed. I'm here. I'm showing up, baby.
I like it. I like it. So I guess let's just hand it off to you.
To you. Yeah, I'm excited. I've been wanting to do this episode with you since the first episode of the Hockey Think Tank podcast, where it was you interviewing me. Since you had quite a following already on Twitter, you were kind of introducing me to your followers. And everybody's been asking, well, when are you going to interview Toph? And so I've been pretty excited and just want to go through through the man, Topher, Christopher Scott. So I'd like to start by saying Topher is a few months older than me. We're both 85 birth years. I grew up always in Topher's shadow, even though he was quite a bit – no, I'm serious. Even though Toph was – quite a bit shorter than me. Toph was, I mean, there were literally people when you would go to tournaments that would say like, oh, he's the next Gretzky. I remember hearing somebody say that. I swear to God, a tournament in Canada. Toph was so good at an advanced age. It was unbelievable. The things that he was doing with the puck and the way he saw the ice.
What happened?
Shut up. Man. So I always looked up to Toph. You know, after a great minor hockey career, he made the Chicago Steel at 15 years old, and I'm guessing he was the youngest player to ever play in the USHL at that point in time. I still remember where I was in my house in St. Louis when he called me and he said, hey, man, I just made this USHL team, the Chicago Steel. And I said, what's the USHL? Didn't even know what it was at that time. But I was excited for him, and I actually went and lived with him that year. So it was really cool getting to see, you know, my big cousin play his first year in junior hockey. Toph wound up playing for the Steel for 4 years, one of which in those years he blew his knee out. And I remember that being one of the toughest times of his life. You know, he wasn't playing for the easiest coaches in Chicago. Mr. Richmond was a guy who he loved playing for, but was a demanding coach. And, you know, it was a little bit different growing up and having all these amateur coaches who were always in your corner. And then you go to juniors and it kind of becomes a business and coaches are trying to get the most out of you any way they can. And I remember that being pretty tough for him. And then he blew his knee out, but Toph being Toph, the resilient mother effer that he is, he came back even stronger. He wound up being an assistant captain his second to last year with the Chicago Steel, putting up 52 points in 60 games. I'll repeat that, 52 points. Oh no, that was his last year, 52 points in 60 games. And he was the Cheddar. Last season, he's wearing the Cheddar at 5-4 in the USHL. 21 goals from not a goal scorer. So that was pretty impressive for me to look at that stat last night. He then went on to play for Cornell University, Ivy League, obviously, because he's got the brains. And all I've ever heard about is how the fans love this guy. I mean, Cornell, if you guys have never watched Cornell hockey, they love big boys over at the Big Red. They're called the Big Red for a reason because those guys are absolute monsters. Like, they love 6'2", 6'3", 6'4", just massive human beings. Topher, while Topher's elite prospect says 5'6". However, we all know Toph's hanging around maybe like 5'4.379". So when you would pan the bench and it would be 6'3", 6'3", 6'4", 6'4", 6'3", 5'4", 6'3", 6'4", just some of the pictures from him standing on the bench were unbelievable. Toph being Toph, absolutely killing it, wound up being an assistant captain his junior year, and he actually wore the C, the Cheddar, his senior year. He had over 100 points in Division I college hockey playing for an Ivy League school. And those of you that don't know, Ivy Leagues generally play a few less games than the rest of college hockey. So for him to put up over 100 points at 5-4, unbelievable. He then finished his college career, went to the Elmira Jackals in the ECHL, putting up 4 points in 7 games. Not a big deal. The following 2 years.
Can we get through this? Jeez.
No. The following – I told you I'm going to make it sweet, baby. The following 2 years, Toph played in the CHL for a couple of different teams, one of them being for one of my former coaches at Western Michigan, Chris Brooks. He went on to be a graduate assistant at Miami of Ohio, working with a lot of top talent. Some of the guys in St. Louis that I know actually has been pretty cool to hear their side of things, how Toph was as a coach right out of the gate. Then he wound up at Cornell, his alma mater, obviously. I mean, I thought he was going to be the president of that school after visiting there for his wedding. But he wound up at Cornell as an assistant coach for a few years. And, you know, after that, he decided he wanted to have a family. And for those of you who don't know, when you're a new assistant coach in the college hockey world, you are low on the totem pole. Toph was telling me he was out of town 230 days a year, and that is insane. It was all recruiting. And at the end of the day, luckily, his wife, Emma, is an absolute rock star and a babe, and they decided they wanted to start a family. Toph left his college coaching gig, and now you know him as the Hockey Think Tank guy. He's all over social media. His main goal is to make hockey players, coaches, fans, parents, everyone have a little bit of inspiration, a little bit of knowledge, a little bit of this, as you know from his intro. But he's one of the best human beings I know. And here he is. So let's take it over to him and let's have him kind of tell his story and how he got into the hockey world and growing up. Let's start there.
Well, thank you for that introduction, Jeffrey. I'm blushing. I grew up in it. I mean, as you know, my dad and your mom's side of the family grew up with hockey, and my mom's side of the family grew up with hockey, and it's kind of been a part of my blood ever since I was born. I think there's a picture of me as a baby in the hospital with little knitted skates on. So something that I was born into, and very, very fortunate that both sides of my family were really passionate about the game.
That's awesome. And I mean, I just remember always coming to your house in Chicago, and I don't know. I don't even know if we ever hung out with the rest of the family. We just ran right downstairs and started playing hockey. You, me, the uncles, you know, back then those older dads and uncles of ours would always be beating us on purpose and chopping my feet, and I'd get so mad at them. Now I'm older and I can beat them up and I love it. But, you know, I'd like to take it to when you played for the Chicago Young Americans. And we've already talked about what Stan Stiopkin did for the way that you looked at the game. But for those of you who don't know, Toph won the Bantam National Championship. How old are you? What's a Bantam now? I don't even know how old that is.
I think it was eighth grade, freshman year of high school, maybe something like that.
So 13, 14 years old, Toph played on the best team in the country. And, you know, like I always talk about my hockey rankings, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't care about that stuff. I care that the kids get better every day. And on this team, my God, did they get better every day. I mean, do you even know how many guys you had play D1 from that team or go pro? I mean, you had many guys go pro and a few guys play in the NHL for sustainable careers.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to kind of talk about the story of what led to that team first, though, because I think that's it epitomizes what I think about youth hockey today. And, you know, growing up, I always kind of played up a level. And up until I think it was my Pee Wee major year, you know, I played with the 84 group, but then I got cut for that 84 group. And I basically didn't have a place to go. There was no other place to go and play. And just by happenstance, this Team Illinois, coached by this Russian guy who we had never heard of or anything like that, they had a spot open on their team. So, because it was pretty much the only place to go, we went. And, you know, he did a practice, and my dad and myself, my dad played college hockey, just kind of fell in love with what he was doing. Very innovative, very outside the box stuff that we had never seen before. It was amazing. Our team was really, really, really bad. We had A players and double A players on our team, and we were playing a triple A schedule. And at the beginning of the year, you know, we were getting smoked, pretty bad. But because of Stan, our coach, we just kept getting better and better and better and better. We play like it's kind of like the ADM now. We played so many games, a ton of skill work. We had literally had zero systems. It was just go out there and play the game. And so by the end of the year, you know, we were in games and we were winning games and stuff like that. And, you know, then the way that youth hockey is today, the, you know, the other team across town with all the better players, they stole all of our better players and they went over to go play for them. And my parents were like, you're not going, like, we're going to continue to play with this coach. And so I was like, okay, because I love playing for him. And so again, we started from the bottom, and you know, didn't do so well at the beginning of the year. And then eventually, we started beating teams that we shouldn't have been beating. And it was an incredible year. And then you know, all the other good players who were on the other side of town, they were kind of like, hey, like, what's going on over there? You know, these kids keep getting better and better and better. So we eventually kind of merged the two teams, and the best players from each team played together for this guy, Stan Stiopkin, who you talked about. And it just took off from there. Like you said, we had one guy who ended up playing in the NHL. His name was Mikey Brown, played a lot of games. He was almost like an enforcer. But the funny thing about Mikey is that he was the last guy picked for the team. The last guy picked for that team was the guy that made it the farthest, which just kind of goes to show you, right? Like, everybody wants to peg kids at such a young age, and it's you shouldn't. Mikey was an unbelievably hard worker. He's a great guy, and you know, ended up 2 years later playing the National Development Program and going to Michigan on a full scholarship. It's just, so that's why when it gets so professionalized and so just pegging young kids is the next thing and all that from such a young age, it's not the right thing at all. And eventually that team, and we've talked about on earlier podcasts, some of the outside the box things that Stan did with us in terms of doing things for our skill development and conditioning level and things like that. But he was an unbelievable coach. I want to say we had probably 8 or 9 guys that ended up playing Division I or in the OHL. A bunch of guys that went up and played pro hockey. Mikey was the only one that made it to the NHL, but it was a special, special year to say the least. And a lot of what I learned from Stan and just seeing how much I got better in those 3 years that I played for him, that experience has shaped a lot of what I see in youth hockey today.
Yeah, I remember, you know, we touched on this for like a second in one of the most recent podcasts, but we went up, you know, Topher and I are the same age, like I said in the intro there. We went up and played against you, and you guys played without a goalie, and you beat us 7-1. I scored the empty net, not a big deal. 7-1 without a goalie, you beat us. Like, my God. Was Al Montoya not on your team?
No, he wasn't on our team at that point. I had played with him a little bit younger, like when we were Mites and Squirts. But at that point, he had moved on to, I think he was playing high school. Yeah, there's another thing. He was playing high school hockey at the time. And
that's right. He stopped playing AAA to play high school. That's right. And then he wound up at Michigan two, 3 years later.
National and Development NHL. Program. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. Yep. Crazy.
All right, so let's take it to the day you made it for the Chicago Steel. So you're a 15-year-old trying out in the USHL. What happens?
It was crazy. It was the first year that the USHL was in Chicago. And, you know, just being from Chicago and our team being as good as we were, you know, it was just like, hey, let's go to tryouts and just get an experience and just kind of see what it's like. And, you know, it's funny because I ended up you know, leading the tryouts and scoring and ended up making the team. And it was crazy. It was crazy. We didn't know what the USHL was. We didn't know what junior hockey was. You know, nothing. But Steve Richmond, like you said, was the coach. And you know, I'd grown up. He was my Squirt AA coach. And his son, Danny Richmond, was one of my best friends growing up and everything. And so my parents trusted Steve and you know, ended up making the team. And what an experience that year was, to say the least.
So let's go through that, because that is a very, especially back then when there were so many, you know, 19, 20-year-olds in the league. What was that experience like being that young? And then because we've talked about this and I know your answer, looking back, do you think that maybe you tried to go to juniors too early?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. That was a really, really tough year for me. And again, it obviously the hockey was a lot better than what I was used to. But I think the biggest thing that was an adjustment, it was tough for me, was as a 15-year-old, you're interested in much different things than 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. And you have certain life experiences that you know, that are very minor compared to what these guys have gone through. And I think just the whole fitting in part and the whole just getting acclimated to what junior hockey is. You know, I was a deer in headlights, and you know, we had some good guys on the team, but at the end of the day, it was a tough transition for me. Again, looking back, I certainly went way too early. You know, I don't have any idea if my development was better or worse because of it. I learned a lot, and I, you know, we talk about resiliency all the time. I had to figure some stuff out on my own end and on how to make it. And so it was a tough experience, but at the end of the day, I think it was good for me. It kind of made me grow up a little bit faster than maybe I should have, but it was a tough year. That's why, you know, kids, like junior hockey, there's no rush to get there. There's no rush to get to junior hockey. I can tell you from personal experience that, you know, living at home and being with your mom and dad and being disciplined by your mom and dad and all that kind of stuff, I was fortunate that I was able to live at home and play junior hockey, but there's no rush to get there. No rush at all.
So I obviously completely agree. I mean, I'd rather a kid go into juniors and be a little bit more on the over-prepared side than under-prepared side. But also to play devil's advocate for me, I always like to be challenged, you know, like I felt like, okay, like if I got to work harder to get up there, then I'm going to play better, you know? So I understand what you're saying there, but let's take it to the process of you deciding on a college and colleges talking to you. Cause you know, a lot of kids are wanting to have that. They want colleges to talk to them. They want to play college hockey. What was that process like and kind of how did it happen? Not just with Cornell, but all the teams you talked to. And I know that they stopped talking to you through your injury. So let's go through all of that.
Yeah. You know, it was my third year playing in Chicago. I was a senior in high school and put a ton of work in. You know, that summer before was the first summer where I really dedicated myself, you know, solely to the game and, you know, started, you know, working out and all that kind of stuff, and had a great summer, came into camp in the best shape I'd ever been in, and was really excited and really confident, and went into, I think we told the story a couple of podcasts ago, went into the Fall Classic. They used to call it the Buck Bowl. It was in Des Moines at the time. And went into the Fall Classic and played really well in the three games that I was there, and, you know, led the USHL in scoring in the tournament. And to be honest with you, it was so surreal, because I grew up in Chicago and always wanted to go to the Michigans and the Wisconsins and the Notre Dames and things like that. And, you know, a ton of these schools that I always looked up going to, they wanted to talk to me after the game. And I thought that was really cool, because that had never happened before. And, you know, I had seen teammates playing junior hockey, getting their college commitments, and, you know, them being really excited and seeing how much it meant to them. And, you know, finally, this was kind of my time to experience that kind of thing. So talked to a bunch of different schools after that. And, you know, the first game of the season after the preseason, we're up in Green Bay. It was actually the first game ever at the Resch Center, the new rink that they have up there in Green Bay. And, tore my ACL, going to the net hard, looking for a rebound, goalie covered the puck and just tried to stop, and just, I don't even know what happened, but just a little tweak in the knee, and there I was out, and ended up missing 4 or 5 months. And that was tough, because after that injury, there was only one school, Brown, that decided to keep in touch with me. And so again, learning experience. And I remember talking to my parents after that, and just being, what are we going to get out of this? You know, this obviously sucks. It's a tough situation, but how can we find a positive in it? And, you know, I had an unbelievable physical therapist worked. I set a goal. And the funny thing about it is, one of my best friends growing up that was actually on that team, that CYA team, his name is Danny Vernard, ended up going to Notre Dame. He actually tore his ACL that exact same game. And he did it like 5 minutes before I did. Just the weirdest thing ever. But so Danny and I kind of had each other to get us through the injuries, and we pushed each other and competed with each other. We both had a goal that we were going to get back after 4 months, which is, you know, earlier than and then they told us we were going to, but we were like, screw you. Like, we're not going to be out that long. And we ended up, again, just being on the phone and pushing each other. And I'm very fortunate to have Danny, because we ended up coming back at the target date that we had set. Probably a little bit early looking back now. Ended up playing the last couple games of the year. And our team didn't make the playoffs, so it was a really, really short year. And then that next year, ended up playing pretty well and ended up committing to Cornell, which was something that was really cool. Great education, great hockey. The year before I got recruited, they made the Frozen Four. And one of the biggest reasons why I went to Cornell is I love to compete and I love to win. I hate to lose. And for a team of that caliber, they'd just been to the Frozen Four. They had a lot of big guys, like you said, and they were looking for me to come in and play more of an offensive role and things like that. I obviously had to earn it, but that's kind of where they saw me. It was a perfect fit. Went on a visit out there. Loved the coaches, loved the play. For the biggest thing is I just love the guys. Like, it was just an unbelievable group of guys. And that's a big reason of why I ended up going to Cornell.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool. I mean, so anybody listening to this who has an injury, you can always look at the positives, always look at the bright sides. And that's what Tolf did. And I remember when he was going through that, and the guy comes back and he scores 21 goals in the USHL. After the first 3 years in the USHL, he had 5, 10, and 2. Tears his ACL, comes back, and he scores 21. So perseverance, learning lessons, determination. Like, just because you get injured and you're knocked down, it doesn't mean you're out. So, Tolf, let's take it to your career at Cornell, college hockey. How someone of – I know we always talk about your size, but – back then, hockey was, I mean, when we played college hockey, when I was playing college hockey, I called it football on skates. Everyone was just getting as strong as they possibly could, and it was just running around full speed and hitting each other. It was crazy. So for the smaller guys out there listening, because there are, and now it's a lot easier to be smaller in the game of hockey. How did that challenge go for you, and how did you see college hockey?
I absolutely loved my experience at Cornell. It was an amazing 4 years, and we won a lot. Playing in front of, I would call it, the best fans in college hockey, the line of faithful. There's nothing like it. And I even remember after my first game there, I had a couple goals, and the whole crowd is chanting my name, and it was like it was so cool. Because playing in Chicago in junior hockey, we didn't get any fans. There were other teams that got fans, but like, we didn't. So it was the first time where my home crowd was actually really cool. And my first 2 years at Cornell, we made the NCAA tournament. We won a championship, the ECAC championship, my freshman year. And we made the final eight. We were a goal away. We lost in overtime to Minnesota my freshman year to go to the Frozen Four, and we lost in triple overtime against Wisconsin my sophomore year to go to the Frozen Four. And it was those games sucked. that was tough. But I think the best part about my time at Cornell, honestly, is the culture that we had there was amazing. Like, the guys and the people that the coaching staff recruited. I have best friends for life. And I know a lot of teams say that, but I think that's a huge part of the reason that we were so good was we just, everybody was bought in. Everybody was pulling on the same rope. Everybody played their role. We were tough. Like, nobody wanted to play against us because we were big and tough and hit and physical and just grinded you down. I got to play with some really, really special players. I think one of the guys that really showed me the ropes was Matt Molson. He was a junior coming in. When I was a freshman, he was like an All-American. He was a stud, leading scorer, all that kind of stuff. But he was an unbelievable leader. And I still remember my first day on campus. Like, he invited me out to do a workout, just me and him, like, just to get to know me. And he completely bagged me on the football field. But it was amazing because, at that time, everybody comes in as a freshman or you get to a new team, maybe it's junior hockey. And, specifically for me, I always had to be the guy that worked the hardest because of my size. And then I got to Cornell and Moles took me out for that workout. There was a whole nother level that I needed to get to. And he showed me what it meant to be a Cornell hockey player. And he showed me, how hard I needed to work to succeed at Cornell. And, and And, you know, just learning little lessons like that is amazing. And, you know, I made a point to kind of try and learn from a bunch of the older guys. We had such a good senior class and junior class that showed us the rope. And I think that leadership aspect was such a huge part of the reason why we were so successful too. And that's why I believe so much in culture. I believe so much in people. You know, a lot of what we talk about on this podcast is not necessarily X's and O's or, you know, ways to, in terms of team, you know, doing things like skill development stuff. We obviously talk a lot about that, but I want to really make sure that people get across the point that, you know, it's all about team. And that's why I love my experience at Cornell so much. We just had an unbelievable group of guys.
So how did you guys pick captains there? Did the coaches pick captains? Did the players pick captains? Because you were an assistant as a junior and you wore the C as a senior. So that's just kind of something I was interested in.
Yeah, no, the players pick the captains. So we get in, and it depends. Sometimes we did it, you know, right after the year. Sometimes we waited after the summer and picked it to see, you know, how guys worked and stuff during the summer and wouldn't pick them to the fall. But, yeah, the players pick the captains. I think that's the way to go. I mean, Schaefer always used to say, dogs know dogs. And, you know, you could think one thing as a coach, but, you know, if the players have a different perception, then, you know, you could be picking the wrong people. And typically it's pretty similar from what the coaches think to what the players think, having been on both sides. But, yeah, we always had the players pick the captains.
Very cool. So you leave Cornell after your senior year, and your first pro stop is in Elmira in the East Coast League. Let's hear about it. How was Elmira? I know how that town is, but I mean, how was Elmira?
I mean, it was really cool. It was pro hockey, man. Like it was the East Coast League. Unfortunately, our season ended a little bit earlier. We were like one of the last teams out of the tournament. So we didn't make the NCAA tournament that year. But got a chance to sign a contract and finish the year in Elmira, which is only 45 minutes away from where Cornell is. So, you know, I was still able to kind of get to some classes and things like that. But it was a great experience, and it was, very different. Pro hockey is very different than college hockey in terms of the way the game is played. And it, you know, it's a lot more of a thinking game. And, you know, I really enjoyed it. And, just a funny story about my first couple games in Elmira. My line mate was, you probably know him. You might've played with him in Providence, Bobby Robbins. You remember him at all?
He was there after I was already gone, because he went over to Europe and came back, and then he wound up making the NHL,
yeah.
Right? The fighter.
So So Bobby Robbins is like a 6'3", 6'4", just huge, jack, gigantic maniac. Like his role is to be a tough guy. And there's some unbelievable clips of him on YouTube. I encourage everybody who's listening to go on YouTube Bobby Robbins, because he is hilarious. But, you know, in my first couple games, and this really was an initiation into pro hockey, and I played on a line with them, and he goes, Toph, he goes, I want you to take the puck to the next to the net on the next shift and kind of bump the goalie. So I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, just kind of go give him like a little elbow or whatever when he covers the puck. So I'm like, all right. So we get in the offensive zone, and I get the puck and I take it to the net, and the goalie covers the puck, and I kind of bump the goalie, which is obviously a no-no. So, you know, two or three of their guys come up to me, and, you know, they give me a face wash or whatever. And then here comes Bobby Robbins coming in. And he goes, if any one of you mother effers touch this kid again for the rest of the game, I'm going to kill you. And I'm like, what? Like, oh, my God. Like, you kind of scared me a little bit. But, dude, I didn't get touched the rest of the game. Like, literally, I had more time and space than I had ever had in my entire life. And I ended up having two assists in that game. One of them was to Bobby, and like it was just the, oh man, that's such a great thing about pro hockey, I think, is just that I don't know, that intangible factor, right? That you don't get in college. So I just thought that was a really, really cool story just to start my pro career. But you know, it was tough too, because, you know, I scored 100 points in college, like you said, and was expecting, you know, hopefully to get an AHL contract and stuff like that. Nope, not one team called me from the AHL. I had a couple teams in the coast call me, and I was like, holy crap, like that's pretty tough. And but then ended up, you know, signing with Elmira for that next year, and came in I only signed a one-way Coast contract, and went to training camp there, and you know, was playing first line in the first couple preseason games. And then, you know, pro hockey, the way that it is, some of the guys from the AHL got called down, and I got bumped down to the second line, a little less ice time. Then a couple more guys got sent down from the AHL, got bumped down to the third line. You know, and 2 weeks into training camp, I went from having what I would consider a pretty good career at Cornell, and I got cut. I got released from the East Coast League. And it was tough. Like, you know, I thought I was outplaying guys. Maybe I wasn't. That was just my opinion. But ended up, you know, just getting less and less ice time as guys kept coming down from the A. And then obviously being on a one-way Coast deal, I got released. And so I had nowhere to go. And then ended up, you know, signing a contract in the Central Hockey League with the Texas Brahmas at the time, and spent a couple months there, and then I got traded in the Central Hockey League. So I went from, you know, being on cloud nine after my Cornell career to getting cut from the East Coast League and traded in the Central Hockey League. And it was you know, a moment of reckoning for me. Like, I didn't know what to do. But I ended up going to the Rio Grande Valley Killer Bees in the Central Hockey League, and you know, tried to work hard and tried to stay positive. And we had a great year that year. We had a lot of younger guys on that team, a lot of them from college that, you know, we did a lot of stuff together and had a great culture and really enjoyed it. And so came back the next year, and I talked about it, I think, a couple podcasts ago, that we had a different culture the next year, brought in some new players, some older guys that were kind of at the end of their careers that didn't care as much, and that really didn't sit well with me. And I didn't handle it in the best way. I would have done a lot of things differently that last year, you know, had I gone back and knowing what I know now and tried to enjoy it a little bit more instead of being pissed off all the time about, you know, the way that things were going in terms of our team. But it was a great learning experience, and I learned a lot through those ups and downs through those last couple years. And just goes to show you that, you know, everything is a learning experience, and I'm a big believer in what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Well, I'd like you to tell the people in more detail kind of that whole situation where things roll downhill in professional hockey. For the people who don't know how hard it is, and Toph kind of said all the East Coast and all the CHL. Back then, the CHL was actually really good. The CHL was almost on par with the East Coast League, wouldn't you say, back then?
Yeah, and it's a merged league now. So, like, there's a bunch of teams that were in the Central Hockey League that are in the East Coast League now when they merged together.
Right, and so here we have Topher Scott, who's the captain of one of the best teams in college hockey, over 100 points in college hockey, and he can't get an American League deal, and he's in the Coast. And half a year later, he's getting released. So that just tells you how hard it is to make it up the ranks in pro hockey. But Toph, I want you to kind of explain, you said all guys got sent down from the American League, and just kind of talk about that for the people who don't know how pro hockey works. You've got NHL contracts, then you've got two-way contracts where it's NHL, AHL, where if you're in the NHL, you make a certain salary. If you're in the AHL, you make a certain salary, but you can go back and forth, you know, seamlessly. Then there's just AHL contracts. Then there's AHL East Coast contracts. Then there's just East Coast contracts. So kind of talk about how those guys coming down, how that affected you, and how it really probably had nothing to do with how you were playing. You said you were playing great. I believe you were probably one of the best players on that team, but in pro hockey, sometimes it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, here's what I'll say. I disagree with you in the fact that I didn't play as well as I should have, because if I did, then I still would have been there, right? Like, I could have been playing well, but at the end of the day, had I been playing better, I would have been there, because there were other guys that were there that were probably on one-way contracts. But I don't like pointing fingers, and I don't like people, you know, blaming things on circumstances. I think, you know, at the end of the day, had I done better than even I thought I could, then I would still be there. But yeah, so the guys that were on the two-way contracts, AHL East Coast League, the AHL team that we were affiliated with at the time was Binghamton. So, you know, guys were coming down from Binghamton after getting cut from up there. And, you know, if you're a draft pick or you're an AHL guy, they obviously want you to get back up there. So you'll get a little bit more playing time, a little bit more of a role. And I just became the odd man out and ended up having to pack my car, drive through Chicago to pick up some more stuff. And I think overall it was a 27-hour car ride in 2 days that I did to get down to Texas. But that was tough. But that's pro hockey. And when you have a dream and you're passionate about something, you go to the ends of the earth to try and make it happen. Unfortunately, just didn't go the way that I had always imagined.
So what made you retire from playing? What happened?
Oh man, I wasn't ready to be done playing. I wasn't ready to be done playing at all. I loved playing hockey. Like I said, that last year was tough, but I still was playing hockey for a living, and that was something that was unbelievable. But I knew at some point that I wanted to get into to coaching, and I had kept a really close relationship with one of our assistant coaches. His name is Brent Brecky at Cornell, and he's actually an assistant coach at Clarkson right now. Consider him a really good friend and a mentor, but he was coaching at Miami of Ohio after he left Cornell the same year that I went to go play pro. And I was just talking to him, and I was asking him, I was like, hey, Brex, you know, what are some things that maybe I need to do to get into coaching? Or is there anything I need to put in place now? Are there people that I should start reaching out to kind of get the ball rolling? And he basically was like, well, we have a graduate assistantship here that's open for next year. It's yours if you want it. I'll talk to Rico and, just to make sure. But, you know, I'm pretty sure he's going to say yes, and you can come and get your master's, and, you can be our graduate assistant. Is that something you'd be interested in doing? And so that was like, that was a holy crap moment for me, because I wasn't ready to be done playing. What an opportunity. You know, that's not something that you pass up very often. I took a couple days and literally didn't sleep at all, because here I'm thinking, what a great opportunity to get into coaching. That's going to be my next passion. But, you know, I'll have to leave the thing that I love so much. And you know, I don't even know if I can live without playing hockey. So literally didn't sleep for like 2 or 3 days. Was talking with Emma, who was my fiance at the time, wife now, and, you know, just pulling my hair out. I didn't know what to do. And so eventually I was like, I have to make a decision now and just go with it, because I can't go any more sleepless nights trying to figure this out. And, eventually it was too good of an opportunity to pass up. So told Brex I'm in. So I think that was in like January. So from January to, you know, whatever is the end of March, I knew that those were going to be my last games. And that was really, really hard. Knowing that every time I hit the ice was going to be kind of like the last times I was going to play for real. Right. And I just remember we were kind of in a playoff race, but not really. And I remember at some point in February, we had lost, we were on a losing streak, and I just remember losing it, just absolutely losing it. I had to go into the coach's room, and I just started bawling my eyes out. And, a couple of the guys saw me and kind of came in, and I had told a couple guys at that point that this was my last go around and that I was going to take that job at Miami, but, it all came out, and I'll never forget that. I'm even emotional talking about it right now. But that was really, really hard. But at the end of the day, it was a great decision, because, you know, Miami was an unbelievable experience and is part of the journey to where I am right now. So, it was tough leaving playing hockey. It's all I ever known. It's my identity. It's all I ever wanted to do. But you make decisions in life sometimes that are tough, and here we are.
What kind of things would you say you learned from that first year of, you're on the staff, you're a graduate assistant, you're not a full blown, coach, but were you like the buddy of the guys? Were you doing video? What kind of things were you doing that first year?
So my experience at Miami was unbelievable. And a lot of the reason because of that is because the coaches that I worked with were awesome. So between Rico Blasi and Brent Brecky and Nick Petraglia, they were such good guys, and they gave me a ton of rope too. So I obviously learned a lot by watching, but they also threw me into the fire, and I was doing a lot of skill work with the players. By the end of the year, I was doing the pre-scouts and the video breakdowns, and things like that. So, in terms of just learning the craft, it was great. And one thing that I'll say too is, that year I watched most of the games from the press box, unless one of the coaches was out recruiting. And in terms of the game of hockey, I learned so much by watching video and doing the pre-scouts and then watching from up top. So you, because you can see, and you could almost predict a lot of the things that were going to happen because you knew the systems we were doing, you knew the systems they were doing, you know what our top players were doing, you knew what their top players were doing. And that's why I think watching video and you know, when you're at a game, even live, like sit up top and just kind of watch. And I learned so much about the game from that year, from even just doing that. But, you know, it was a great group of guys. We won the CCHA championship that year. We were a number one seed going into the tournament. We ended up losing in the first round to UNH, but, Andy Mealy won the Hobie Baker that year. And that was a year where I really recognized how much hard work for an individual player can go into, you know, being better. Because Meals, he worked so hard that year. We did so much stuff together. You know, he would literally, I think I said it on an earlier podcast, literally I would be late to classes because he was like, you're not going to class, you're going to work with me and do stuff. But it just, you just saw him get better and better and better, and saw a bunch of the other guys that started to do that stuff too get better and better. And it was an unbelievable experience. And the people that I worked with were great. The opportunity that he gave me to kind of make mistakes and be a full-blown coach on the staff was unbelievable. And can't say enough about my time in Miami. It was awesome.
Very cool. Very cool. So then you finish your graduate assistantship, I guess you call it, at Miami. What's the next stop?
Next stop is Cornell. So, and again, you know, you got to get lucky sometimes, right? So that year where I finished up my degree at Miami, both assistant coaches at Cornell left. So Casey Jones went to take the head coaching job at Clarkson, and Scotty Garrow, who was actually a coach of mine, he ended up taking an assistant coaching job at Princeton. And so there were two jobs open. And typically in college, you want to hire guys with recruiting experience because recruiting is such a big part of the game. And but because both of the coaches left, you know, Schaaf thought that he can, you know, get a guy who didn't have as much experience. And so I was able to get that job. And I mean, my time coaching at Cornell, again, I learned a lot. It was a great experience. Benny Sayer, who I think he even might have talked to you when he was at Quinnipiac. He talked to everybody.
Hounded me.
Exactly.
Talked to everyone in Omaha. Everyone knew Ben Sayer.
So, I mean, I honestly can't say enough good things about this guy. To come in my first year as a full-time assistant coach, to learn from Benny, I still consider him one of my best friends. I talk to him all the time. Unbelievable human being, and just he was the best. He was the absolute best. And, you know, talk to Emma and talk to his wife, you know, we talk to each other more than we talk to our wives, you know, being on the road and talking hockey and talking recruiting and all that kind of stuff. And, he was a great mentor for me, and I learned so much from him too. And, was a big part of the reason my experience at Cornell was great, was just being able to work with him. And again, it all goes back to people. Like, we talk about it all the time. Like, if you want to have a good experience, you want to get better, surround yourself with the best people. And I've been very, very fortunate in my career, both playing and coaching, to be surrounded by great people. I had great family, as you know. I have great coaches growing up. I had great friends in high school and growing up. I mean, we never got into trouble, and we were, you know, didn't do things that kids are doing at much younger ages now in terms of, you know, drinking and all that kind of stuff. Just had a great support system. And, you know, obviously I think God has blessed me with some pretty good talents, but there's no way that I got to where I get to without having unbelievable people in my corner.
Yeah, you've got one really good person in your corner right now. That's for sure. He's talking to you. How about, I remember a line from that movie Mystery Alaska where John Beebe's wife is trying to like console him and is like, well, John, you know, every former player turned coach always says that they prefer coaching to playing. And his answer is something to the effect of, well, that's because they can't play anymore. So what would you say? What have you liked more, being a player or a coach?
Oh, dude, player. 100 times out of 100. I love coaching. You know, it's an unbelievable experience being able to, you know, mold the next generation, if that's what you want to call it, and have a positive influence on younger kids. But at the end of the day, there's nothing like playing hockey. You know, even when we get back together and play some higher level hockey, with whether it's alumni games, you get good skates in your town or stuff like that, it gets your blood flowing like never before. And I still miss playing. There's parts of me that still thinks I could play. I'm sure there's still parts of you that thinks you could play. There's nothing like being a hockey player. That's our identity from when, you know, we put the skates on to when we take them off at the end of the day. And I think I don't know if I'll ever, you know, that'll ever change.
Love that. I'm the same way. So we had our talk with, we recorded our talk with the mental coach, Matthew Calderoni, yesterday. Not sure when we're putting that one out, but we talked a lot about reflection with him. And I wanted to have you reflect back on your career, because, you know, our whole goal of this podcast is to help people and advise them and tell them about our experiences and how they can learn from them. Looking over everything from start of your career, you know, as a youngster till now, what are some of the, you know, the landmines you would have tried to avoid? What are some of the biggest pieces of advice you think would affect the most people? Like, what are some things looking back at your own personal career that you could say, you know what, maybe I would have done this differently, or this definitely helped me, just for everyone listening?
You know, it's funny. You talk about landmines. We all hit landmines, and, you know, landmines are a big piece of the journey, and they're necessary pieces of the journey. And I would say that the landmines that I hit, you know, in terms of going to junior hockey too early, maybe a little bit, tearing my ACL, you know, what happened with me in pro hockey and not making it as far as I wanted to go, it's all part of the journey, and it's all a learning experience. So, you know, you talk about what would I avoid? I wouldn't avoid any of it. You know, I wouldn't trade any of those tough times for other things, because I love where I'm at right now. You know, I have a beautiful family. I have a daughter. My wife and I are going on 9 years of marriage. We have a house over our heads, a lot of love, and that's all that really matters at the end of the day. And had it not been for those experiences, good and bad, I wouldn't be here. And so in terms of avoiding landmines, I wouldn't. I would go right through them. You know, in terms of lessons that I've learned, the biggest thing that I've learned throughout this journey in my hockey career is it's all about people. It literally is all about people. You know, if you surround yourself with the right people, you're in a good spot, and you're going to enjoy your experience. You're going to learn. I'm not saying there's not going to be tough times, but those people will help you through the tough times. And I absolutely, by choice of luck, got born to two unbelievable parents. You know, my mom and dad are two of the best people that I know. And they have helped me through so much. They always taught me to believe in myself no matter what. You know, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them. I have an amazing sister. My sister is, you know, Jess, she is passionate. She is, you know, she's going to get what she wants. She is, you know, just driven. She's a special education teacher and does so much for kids with special needs. And, you know, she's got a beautiful family with two sons and a great husband now. And, you know, and then there's my brothers. And I've talked about my brothers on a few podcasts. Like, to me, they're the most inspirational people that I know. So my little brothers are 7 years younger than me. They both have special needs. They've taught me so much in life, you know, about empathy, about perseverance, about perspective. I would not be the person I am today if it wasn't for Max and Jake, my little brothers. And I go back to it. The impact that they've had on me, as 7 years younger and having special needs, just what they go through on a day-to-day basis and how they persevere through things, you know, they're my heroes. And I would not be the person I am today if it wasn't for them. And I'm trying really hard not to get emotional right now. yeah, you know how I get when I talk about them. They're the best. And again, it all goes back to people. Everybody that I've had in my corner, everybody that's challenged me, everybody that supported me, I honestly couldn't ask for better people that I've had. And that's what it's all about, right? It's all about the people.
That's awesome, buddy. And I know Maximus is listening, and Jake the Snake, I know he listens sometimes too. We love you guys. And just a teaching point off of that, because I know some of the hard times that they had to go through in high school when I was living with you and right after, and they were, you know, telling me about kind of some of the things they were going through. And then something recently that happened in my own organization with not good teammates and bullying and stuff like that. And I just want to say to all the kids out there listening, like, your teammates are your family. Like, here Toph is here sitting here at 33 years old, and he's talking about how much fun and how he can remember like it was yesterday playing on his Bantam team at 14 years old. I mean, it's almost 20 years later, and he remembers every second of it. So just I want you to think about that when you're going in the locker room, and maybe there's a kid on the team who's, you know, skinny like I was, or maybe there's a kid who's chubby, or maybe there's a kid who's goofy, or he's only got one parent. Like, that's your team. That's your family away from your family. Like, lift everyone around you up. Topher and I have talked before on this podcast about you don't want to surround yourself with energy vampires. Be that person in the locker room that puts everyone in a good mood, that makes everyone smile, that makes everyone work hard, that makes everyone happy. Don't ever put people down. It's a waste of your time. You know, you're not helping anyone with that bullshit. Like, be a good person. That will get you further in life than putting anyone down ever. And the more people you can bring up with you as a team for when it's relating to hockey, you will be a better team. There's nothing like being on a team that cares for each other, loves each other, protects each other. There's nothing like that. And the rest of your life, you'll remember those teams where everyone's a brother.
Yeah, yeah. And just to kind of go along with that, I don't think that can be understated enough. You know, my brothers were bullied on their hockey teams. They were able to make their JV hockey team right outside of Chicago, and they were bullied. And that was the hardest part about being away at Cornell, was the fact that I knew that stuff was going on, and I wasn't around, you know, as the big brother to kind of put an arm around and stuff like that. And there's only so much you can do over the phone, and there wasn't FaceTime or anything like that at that point. But yeah, the kids need to know your words matter. You know, how you treat people matters. And you might think sometimes you're sarcastic and you're joking and things like that, but you never know. You never know the effect that you're having on other people. So why be negative? Like, why put people down? It doesn't make any sense. It's not going to get you anywhere in life. And at the end of the day, I saw how much they struggled being bullied by people in their high school and people on their hockey team. And, you know, it's not right. And it, you know, we always talk about with our guys, that's unacceptable. And coaches too, have a pulse, like know if that stuff is going on, be around and talk to the kids and see what's going on. Because, you know, had my brothers had coaches that, you know, tried to form relationships with the players and tried to impart some positivity and wisdom on them, you know, maybe that stuff doesn't happen. So I think coaches are as big a part of it as the kids, and they need to know what's going on in their locker rooms, and they have to, you know, ask questions and be a part of it too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a psychologist by any means. I mean, you have way more background in psychology than I do, obviously, but usually, you know, don't they say like, if you're putting other people down, it's because of something you're insecure about
in
your own life.
Yeah, insecurities. Yeah, for sure.
So, I mean, if you're feeling like you need to do that, like we talked about earlier, like, why don't you go look in the mirror and reflect and be like, why am I saying this about other people? Why do I need to feel like good off of putting someone else down? And seriously think about it. And especially if you're on a team, like, are you jealous that they're getting more coaching time, whatever it is? And then, you know, just talk to them in a positive way and try and change it and try and go and get whatever it is that you're missing. Whether it's you need to talk to the coach more, or you want to play more, maybe you got to work harder. I see so many kids that get jealous of, you know, the best player on the team because he's playing so much. Well, he's probably working the hardest, or he's doing this when you're not looking. So don't put him down. Be like, hey, can I work with you? Can I do this with you? Like, let's bring everyone up. The world needs more love, and being on a team is a special thing. I mean, there's nothing like playing on youth sports teams and pro teams and college teams, all these teams. It is so much fun. When you get to the real world, it's a little more cutthroat. So enjoy your time with your teammates and form relationships, and they'll last forever. And you never know, looking at it selfishly, you never know on your team who's going to be like the next Bill Gates. So maybe be nice to that nerdy guy, because, you know, maybe he's going to be a billionaire and later on he can fix your computer or something.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. No, it's all about people, man. I mean, I've always known that, and then when I got into the college recruiting game, that's even amplified even more. You meet so many people, 95% of them good, and you know, you get to. Honestly, the best part about being an assistant coach at Cornell was when you offer a kid a spot on the team and they take it, and you know that you've changed that kid's life forever. You know, I mean, that's such a cool feeling, and you see how much the kid gets excited by it. But then you take a look at mom and dad, and you know how much do parents sacrifice for kids? You know, like it's insane. And I certainly won the parent lottery. I think you would probably say the same thing. You know, seeing the parents look, and maybe it's not even necessarily the parents thinking that their kid is getting a great opportunity, but they see their kids and how proud they are of their kids for the work that they put in. But then you just know how much work that the parents and the sacrifices that they had to. That was the best part about my job, being able to do that for people. And, you know, I was sitting in their shoes, you know, 10 years earlier, 15 years earlier, being that kid that got really excited. And yeah, goo, we're old.
Goo. 15 years, Jesus.
Yeah, maybe not 15 years, but 10 years.
14,
whatever. That was cool. That was a cool part of my job. And that's a big piece of what I miss is the recruiting side of it and meeting so many good people and forming relationships with coaches around the country and families and kids. That was pretty neat.
That's awesome, buddy. So let's finish it off here with kind of what you're doing now. You know, you started the Hockey Think Tank website. You started the Hockey Think Tank podcast with an extremely attractive, charismatic co-host. And
that's,
you know,
debatable.
Got me. You know, where do you see yourself in the next few years? Like, what do you have going on? I mean, I know what you have going on now, but for the listeners, what do you have going on now? What are your goals? What do you want to do with this Hockey Think Tank website, podcast, all these things? Where do you want to be?
I don't know. I'm just trying to live in the moment. That's one thing that I've learned over the past couple of years, you know, not being around the game and having a lot of time to reflect and, you know, not having every day being very structured and crazy. You know, I'm trying to live in the moment, and that's a huge piece of what I'm trying to do. But, you know, when I got done coaching and I decided to leave, Cornell, I didn't have a plan B. And I've been very open on this podcast that was a really, really tough time. Cause as you know, I mean, players struggle with that all the time. When you feel like you don't have an identity anymore, or a purpose, that's tough. And, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I've been very open that I went to and sought some counseling just to kind of try and help and figure some stuff out, because you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And that was kind of tough. But at the end of the day, it all went back to what I've said the whole time, is that just surround yourself with good people, right? So I started having some conversations with Brandon Nerado and Brian Kane, who we're going to have on the podcast at some point, and just to kind of, you know, shoot the breeze and talk hockey and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, that led to us getting together one night in January in Detroit and saying, hey, like, why don't we do something? Like, and one of the things that I really learned through my time as a coach at Cornell, and then, you know, after that, just talking to a lot of people about the youth hockey game, was that there's just a huge need for education in the sport right now. And not just educating people on, you know, X's and O's and systems and skill development and hockey development, but culture development and too, because the youth hockey world right now, I don't think is very healthy. And so we were like, hey, like, let's just put a lot of information out there. Let's see what we can do. And we ended up coming up with an idea to start this website. And it's kind of gotten us to where we are now with the podcast and, you know, just trying to do as much as we can to educate people that are passionate about hockey about the right way to do things. And I mean, not necessarily the right way to do things, but our opinion on how we think things should be done. And I'm enjoying the hell out of it, man. And where do I see myself in 5 years? I have no idea. You know, I'd be lying if I didn't say I would love to get back into the higher levels of hockey at some point. You know, right now that's not in the cards. I'm loving what I'm doing with this and want to continue doing this and see where it goes. But I'm having a blast doing this. I'm having a blast talking to people about hockey that I've never met, and getting emails and texts and you know, messages on social media and stuff. And really appreciate the following that we've kind of garnered here with what we're doing. And hopefully we can continue to make a positive difference in the hockey world. That's our goal.
Very cool, Toski. Well, I know that I feel lucky to be doing this with you, and I know a lot of people You know, like we both get a lot of positive feedback from this, and it's very cool that we get to be doing that. And you know, there's something to be said for just whatever your biggest passion is, just try and make that your life. Because I mean, I don't think I've ever worked a day in my life. I played hockey in my first career. I own a training company for hockey players now that I retired, and I do this. I mean, every day I get to talk hockey. I get to hang out with you. I get to hang out with young hockey players that are hungry to get better, and it is so exciting. And, you know, I kind of followed your footsteps. I saw how passionate you were with coaching, and I was like, okay, I'm going to stay in hockey, and he loves what he's doing, and I love helping people. And it's really cool that we were able to kind of bring our passions together and be able to work on this project together. And for those of you listening, don't ever be afraid to reach out to Tof, because he is a great person. And if you have a question or you have something, don't be afraid to message him on Twitter, Instagram, email him. I think is, what is it, Hockey Think Tank Topher? What is it?
AmazingGolfBallWhackerGuy@gmail.com. Topher@thehockeythinktank.com. And seriously, like, I really mean it too. Reach out. If I can help any kind of situation, please do. That's why we're doing this. And I wanted to say too, cause I kind of glazed over it before, but you know, when I left coaching, I did, you know, I don't want to say I was in a really rough spot, but I was in a tough spot. You know, I had left my dream job and, you know, didn't have a plan B of what I wanted to do. And so I mentioned that I had went and gone and sought counseling. And it wasn't a big deal, right? Like I went and saw somebody and she just kind of helped me get my thoughts in order. And I know there's a lot of people out there who are struggling, with whatever. Some people have much more, you know, tougher problems than I did and other people do. Please, please, please don't be afraid to go and ask for help. You know, even if you're a kid and you want to get on the same page as your coach, please go talk to them. If you're having mental health issues or, you know, if there's something bothering you, please don't be afraid to ask for help. You're not weak. You're actually strong for asking for help. I think that's one of the strongest things you can ever do. There's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with anybody. Just people go through different things that sometimes they don't know how to handle. And sometimes you just need a different perspective on how to think about certain situations that you're in, or even what you think about yourself. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, there's a lot of really good people in this world, who are willing to go the extra mile for anybody. But sometimes you just have to take that initiative and ask for it. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I encourage anybody has questions or are struggling with anything, whether it's me, whether it's Jeff, whether it's anybody in your family or whatever it may be, reach out. And there's always people there to help. That's the one great thing about this world. With all the negativity that's going on in this world, sometimes we forget that, you know, 99% of the people that surround us are really good people and be willing to do things for you. So just wanted to, you kind of led into that right there with the last thing that you were saying. So I wanted to make sure that that I got that out there.
I love it, buddy. Absolutely love it. For anybody who's a newer listener, this podcast was all about Tof. Tof, on our first ever podcast, did the same thing and flipped the script, and he interviewed me, because I know we've had more and more followers. So I encourage you guys to go back who are newer listeners and not only listen to one where Tof interviewed me, but listen to all the beginning episodes that we had. I mean, Rob Schremp, Cam Jansen, and we've had so many guests that have given so much positive information and stories, and you know, I listen to these all the time because I learn something new every time I listen to them. And I'm like, man, yeah. So if you're a newer listener, I hope you like this episode where we got to get a little more into Tof's head. But keep liking, sharing, all that stuff. And don't be afraid to message us. And we'll see you next time on the Hockey Think Tank podcast.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week. And look forward to continuing doing this with everybody.
I don't know what to do with my hands.
I'll just press stop.